Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Philip Roth was a giant of the literary profession who changed the job for readers as well as writers. It turns out, in Blake Bailey's 800-page biography, that Philip Roth, who died of heart disease 3 years ago, is still nearly alive, still embattled with his second wife, Claire Bloom, still hurt and angry, still funny and loving as well, still angling for the last word, still happy to be contradictory. This is a bold, self-studying soul who could write through his favorite alter ego, Nathan Zuckerman, that he was frightened of everything, frightened of being known, frightened of being forgotten, frightened of being bizarre, and frightened of being ordinary, frightened of himself and his instincts, and frightened of being frightened, unconsciously suppressing his talent for fear of what it might do next. That's pure Roth, and we'll hear more in his own voice this hour from a long conversation we recorded at his farm in Connecticut 15 years ago. Where was he then, I wondered, in the long arc of his work and life?
Where am I? Well, writing. And writing and writing and writing.
Blake Bailey, on the strength of three literary biographies before this one, you're the man Philip Roth chose to represent him after death. With that curious instruction he gave you, he said, "I don't want you to rehabilitate me, just make me interesting." I wonder, Blake Bailey, when you summon the whole man today, what is Philip Roth saying? Where is he now? Is he smiling?
Philip is being driven at the wall. There are people who view the opportunity to review a biography of Philip Roth as an opportunity to indulge in cultural pontification. Look, you need to put aside for a moment the various PC issues about Philip Roth and remember how massively important this person is to Western culture. What a massive achievement his work represents. Philip affected sort of an Olympian detachment from critiques of his alleged personal affairs and so forth. He never publicly answered Claire Bloom for leaving A Doll's House. And perhaps people conclude on the basis of that, Philip was actually Olympianly detached. This was not the case.
Oh, he wrote, what, 275 pages that he didn't publish about Claire Bloom's book?
Indeed, and much more than that about his former best friend, Ross Miller. Philip was an obsessive, extremely vulnerable human being. It hurt him deeply and incessantly that he was perceived in certain disparaging ways.
What difference does his presence make? And you had innumerable hours with him. I'm thinking of my own couple of encounters. He was so bright. His eyes were so active. He was friendly, a welcoming presence. What difference does that make in your general sense of him?
Philip, at his best, as you seem to know, was a delightful person. And, you know, the first time I met him at his apartment on the Upper West Side, he was kind of stern. He was stern because he was sizing me up and he didn't know whether he wanted to let me into his life, which is completely understandable. He had just had another spinal fusion surgery, so he was in pain. And he wanted to intimidate me. And what you have to remember about Philip was no matter how stern he seemed, and even if he was trying to kind of browbeat you, his humor was always just beneath the surface and could always, always be appealed to.
Blake, I want to try out three sort of summary impressions that I picked up, a lot of reading and some visiting with the man. One, Philip Roth was all writer, all the time, disciplined, driven to the limit. He reminds me of John Coltrane, and who was inseparable from his horn. 24 hours a day was not enough. As he wrote about his model writer in The Ghostwriter, his subject, E.I. Lanoff, his hero, says, "I turn sentences around. That's my life. I write a sentence and then I turn it around. Then I have lunch. Then I come back in and write another sentence. Then I have tea and turn the new sentence around. Then I read the two sentences over and turn them both around. Then I lie down on my sofa and think.
That's great stuff, isn't it?
It's incredible. But it sounds like Roth. It sounds like John Updike coming into his office, looking across the street at the dentist's office, seeing him setting up his tools, and going to work. But he did it longer. I want to underline that it's an excruciating job for a lifetime. I mean, his character, Lanoff, who turns sentences around, says, I sit back down at my little Olivetti and start looking at sentences and turning them around. And I ask myself, why is there no way but this for me to fill my hours? It's work and then some.
I love the portrait of Lanoff in The Ghostwriter. And The Ghostwriter is probably my favorite of Roth's novels. For any aspiring writers out there, the best advice that Lanoff or any of us can give you is winnow your life down to the bare essentials so that you have no choice but to sit at your desk and turn sentences around, because there's nothing else you particularly want to do.
Well, yeah, he hears that self-description and he says, that's my life ahead. I can't wait.
Yeah, he thinks that that's his life ahead, but he thinks of the Jewish writer in terms of what Isaac Babel said, that the Jewish writer is a person with spectacles on his nose and autumn in his heart. And Zuckerman adds, and blood in his penis. And that is the essential difference between Lanoff and Zuckerman, and between, for that matter, Malamud and Roth. People who take a dim view of Phillips' alleged private misbehavior should, at the very least, bear in mind that the vast majority of his waking hours was spent all by himself standing at a desk in the woods of Connecticut.
Second general point I carry away is that his material all comes from his life and his insides, but he is a divided soul, self-critical, contrarian, as he said, part Henny Youngman, part Henry James, between the Borscht Belt stand-up comedy, and he was a genius at it, and then the ultimate refinement of literary prose. So it's not exactly a war inside him, but there's a split there.
Yes. I define it at the end of my book as a tripartite division. There is the nice Jewish boy, and Philip, from a young age, after the Maggie disaster, his first wife, he said, just as Chekhov had to squeeze the surf out of himself drop by drop, I have to squeeze the nice Jewish boy out of myself drop by drop, because it got me in this fix and it almost destroyed me. But he never stopped being the nice Jewish boy. He had a streak of filial piety a mile wide. Yep. He looked after his sick and ailing friends. He was generous and so forth. He was also Mickey Sabbath. Okay.
Yeah, but I was just going to say, that would be my third general point, that he has chosen to play the part of Céline, a writer that I don't know and most Americans don't, but he was a modern French master, a misanthrope, anti-Semite, vulgar, and a great writer of the grotesque. He was at the far pole from everybody's favorite 20th century French writer, Marcel Proust, but Philip adored Céline, and he said, Céline is my Proust, Mr. Grotesque.
Sure, and Céline is the guiding spirit to Sabbath Theater, certainly, to Portnoy's Complaint, certainly. The ranting and raving and misanthropy, and also the satire, is very Céline-esque, if that's a word.
What survives the toxic mix of all these things in Philip? The Jekyll and Hyde in him both, in full flower.
But as Martin Amis said of Sabbath Theater, Mickey Sabbath, there's no Dr. Jekyll in Mickey Sabbath. Mm. Mickey Sabbath's manifesto is to affront and affront and affront until there is nobody left unaffronted. And there was that side to Philip, decidedly so.
So plays Philip Roth today, his reputation in his afterlife, but especially who's reading him? And who is not? I'm particularly interested in what young writers in a different literary age make of his example.
Certainly young writers tend to revere Philip, especially young fiction writers. Zadie Smith, Nicole Krauss, Jonathan Leatham, Nathan Englander, are much influenced by Philip, not only his work, but also his example as an artist, his utter and absolute unstinting devotion to pursuing his craft.
But what about that relentless search in the dark, and the dark in the dark?
Look, I discuss the various versions of Portnoy's complaint and that the slow evolution of that book. And there's that manuscript, the penultimate version, okay? And it's yet another attempt to fictionalize the Maggie disaster, the disaster of his first marriage, namely the urine fraud. Maggie to...
Her fraud,
to keep from being thrown out by him, said, "You can't throw me out, I'm pregnant." And he said, "Prove it," and gave her a herring jar to pee into. She peed into it. She went to Tompkins Square Park, poured out her pee, and paid $2 or $3 to an obviously pregnant woman to pee into the jar. And hence got married to Philip. He was obsessed. There are thousands of pages at the Library of Congress of him struggling to fictionalize this. Portnoy began that way. On about page, 200 and something, he's been writing about Erica, the Maggie character, and how she viciously betrayed him. And he starts talking about his mother, the source of the crippling guilt that led him to capitulate to Erica / Maggie in the first place. And suddenly, Chris, the prose is transformed. It comes alive on the page before your eyes. And that's what Philip had to go through. He said, "Sometimes I write a whole first draft with a single salvageable sentence in it, and I throw all of it away and start with that sentence." He wasn't overstating the case.
But he wasn't over the wound either.
He never got over any wound, Chris, ever. He nursed his wounds. A writer to write has to hate something.
But there's no exorcism here. Is there not?
If Philip had not been a writer, I don't think he would have lived beyond the age of 30.
Wow. Coming up, the Newark, New Jersey, of Philip Roth's boyhood. And after the riots of the 1960s, the lost city of his imagination. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with the biographer Blake Bailey. We're tuning in on the voice of Philip Roth, written into his novels, spoken in real life. I'd had a chance to record an unmapped conversation with Philip Roth back in 2006 on the publication of a late novella titled Every Man. It was a meditation on old age and approaching death. I asked him for a word about his work process that his readers don't see.
Your work is so smooth, flows so inevitably and so confidently. What's the process that we don't see?
Well, you don't see any of the process, of course. You begin, as you know, with nothing. Generally, I begin in desperation, because nothing breeds desperation. Where you get an idea from, I don't begin to know. But fortunately, some small notion enters your brain. Then I begin to write things down. If I can emerge from my studio with a page, I'm not downhearted. If I emerge with less, I'm pretty frustrated. If I emerge with nothing, then I want to slit my throat.
Don't.
Well, I haven't so far, but I have emerged sometimes with nothing. And then sometimes you can't go, you just can't go any further. It's not writer's block. That's not the right phrase to describe it. Is that you're not penetrating the material in the way that will release whatever is strongest in you. The great goal is to connect enough sentences together until you get a first draft, until you've completed the story in its crudest form. And however crude it may be, it's enormous relief to have this thing there. Because now you have something that you can read. So to go back a second time, you see what's missing. And in this book, for instance, use Every Man as an example. you're reading the thing and you say his father's a jeweler, and you keep reading and then you say to yourself, are you a writer or what are you? You're talking, you say his father's a jewelry store. What's a jewelry store? Let's think about it. So I, as a kid, I worked during the holiday season for a big department store, and we all did, in Newark called Bambergers. And you would be a stock clerk, and you'd work one day in this department, one day in another department. And, you know, you'd carry things back and forth. I was in the jewelry department for a little bit, so I did see a few things, but by no means everything I have there. And then there are lots of jewelry stores if you walk up Broadway in New York City. So you take a walk up, and suddenly you see there are dozens of jewelry stores where you saw nothing before. And you look in the window, and you go inside, and you see if you got somebody who's willing to talk. And eventually, you hear a few things. And you don't need much, you know. Tolstoy is reputed to have said, you could have written, you could write War and Peace if you've seen a street fight.
Blake Bailey, explain the differences you see it, or the continuity between early Roth, which comes to a peak in Portnoy, I suppose, and later Roth, American Pastoral, an epic novel of America in his hometown, Newark. What happened? What changed in Philip Roth and what didn't?
Oh, boy. There is, to my knowledge, no more protean career in American letters, okay? I mentioned in my prologue, in 2006, the New York Times canvassed something like 200 literary critics and professors and so forth to name the best American novel of the last 25 years, from 1981 to 2006. Of the final list of 22 American novels, six were by Philip Roth. Now, one needs to bear in mind that Philip's career was 55 years long, and on the other side of 1981 was Portnoy's Complaint in 1969. That's on the Modern Library list of the 100 greatest English language novels. 10 years before that, in 1959, is Goodbye Columbus, which made him the youngest ever winner of the National Book Award at age 26. On the other side of 2006 is Everyman and all those Nemesis novels, which are profound meditations on human fate and mortality, and very somber, very unlike the farceur who wrote Portnoy's Complaint, Our Gang, much less the sort of gentle satire of Goodbye Columbus. So if you want to talk about how Philip evolved and changed over the course, you are looking at something that is truly awesome.
Mm. His friend and mine, Bernard Avishai, says that the story of Philip Roth that he experienced was a man growing into manhood in the most studied, considered way, but it was about his growth, his evolution, his wanting to meet his own improvised, continuing definition of what a man is all about. Is that part of your story?
Yes, I think that that's a very apt way to put it.
You feel it very specifically in The Ghostwriter. He's come to an idol to see how the guy does it, and that's going to be his life. But it is not just about writing, it is about a man's responsibilities.
Well, it's also about a man who's casting off his family and his community for the sake of his art. Hmm. And Philip, or rather Nathan, wants to be judged on the basis of aesthetic merit. And that's very much to the point of how Philip began. He published Goodbye Columbus. It was about these parvenu suburban Jewish Bulgarians who aspired to be of the country club set. And Philip made fun of Jews. And Brenda Potemkin, who I think is a very sympathetic character, she's spunky, she's sexy, but she's having premarital sex and she's using a diaphragm. And that was heavy stuff in 1959. So he was reviled by the Jewish establishment right from the beginning. And Philip had to say, you know, I'm my own man. I am not primarily a Jewish American writer. I'm an American who happens to be a Jew.
I got to say about the Brenda Potemkin character, that hurt the real woman. She said later it ruined her family's life. Her brother was sore. The father was sore. All of them parodied in a cruel way by Philip. Why did that have to be?
that in revealing his own growth, he had to smear the people he was closest to.
Yeah, well, you write about what you know. And if you don't want to write about what you know accurately, if you don't want to let the repellent in, then you don't have much business being a writer.
That was his code and his phrase, let the repellent in.
Let the repellent in. He didn't spare himself either, right? He spent much of his career responding to the mortifying fame of Portnoy's complaint. That was largely autobiographical, and it's about a chronic masturbator and chaser of shiksas and so on and so forth. So Philip didn't spare himself, and he didn't spare anyone else in his life either. He said he was fond of quoting Czesław Miłosz, saying, once a writer is born into a family, the family is finished.
Oof. So many examples.
That said, Philip's family doted on him. His brother, when Philip finally was given the Pulitzer, which had been denied to him for so long for American Pastoral, Sandy burst into tears. Sandy adored his brother.
Cancel culture was just getting started when Philip hung up his spikes. What would cancel culture have done with him, and what is it doing to him even today? Specifically, his notion of a novelist and an artist is somebody who shakes things up, including himself. That is not today's model of a novelist, even. It isn't Zadie Smith. It isn't George Saunders.
No, I think that Philip transcends that. But, I mean, as far as Zadie Smith, there's a reason Philip chose her to give the first annual Philip Roth lecture at the Newark Public Library, in which he said, in effect, I learned from Portnoy, I learned from Roth, not to put noble black characters in my work. I'm not a propagandist. I'm a recorder of human behavior.
Going the other way, I wonder what the broad school of so-called autofiction, led by six volumes of Carl Ove Knausgård on his growing up and his secret self, and what has that done to redeem the Roth version of digging, 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 introspection, confession?
Well, of course, Philip liked to play with the reader's expectations, you know. I mean, whereas Knausgård is minutely regurgitating the stuff of his own life, whereas Philip liked to play with that. You know, Philip was toying with the infinite malleability of life and basically saying that it's silly to think that just because Zuckerman is also a writer who also wrote a Portnoy-like book titled Karnofsky, that it has anything to do with me.
I'm just wondering, did Philip tell too much about himself? I mean, the charge is narcissism, and he left you with an impossible task almost of finding something new that he hadn't somehow told or metamorphosized in his fiction.
But Chris, it wasn't an impossible task at all. By the time I finished this book, I could tell you to a nicety where the life at various points diverged from the fiction. And in many ways, I think the life is as interesting or more so.
The life is sweeter. I'm thinking, for example, of his tribute to John Updike on Updike's death. It's more loving, more quotable than anything Updike ever wrote about any writer, but basically he puts him in the company of Hawthorne in American history and Melville. I mean, what more could a rival say? And he said it lovingly, I think.
Very lovingly. He had enormous affection and respect, rightly so, for Updike. Philip, whatever his faults otherwise, was not petty and rivalrous among his peers. He was extremely generous. Judith Thurman, he read her biography of Isaac Dinesen and immediately wrote her a letter. This is fabulous. I love this, etc. That was Philip. And if he thought you deserved to be helped, he would stop at nothing to promote your career. Louise Erdrich won for her first novel the very prestigious Sue Kaufman Award from the Academy of Arts and Letters. She never knew, after 33 years of friendship with Philip, that he was the one who put her up for that. I found it in the files, him nominating her for that award. That was Philip. He was very magnanimous to other writers.
One of the others who was equally generous with him in a beautiful way, Edna O'Brien, who adored Philip, although they were never lovers, she said at his 80th birthday, "So, friends, this is the tip of the iceberg. I can only give you a glimmer of the complexity of the man that is Philip Roth. Feared and revered, plagiarized, envied, hermit and jester, lover and hater, by his own admission, foolish and yet fiercely formidable, too adorable for words, a true friend, and undoubtedly one of Yeats's Olympians," which made him Irish in the end.
Isn't that great? Fantastic. It's hard to improve on that. It's all true. What irritates me among some of Philip's particularly younger critics is they're not willing really to grapple with the man's humanity. He's a monster. Any attempt to sort of balance the accounts of Claire Bloom or shed light on the relationship with Maggie, everything's settling scores against Philip. Young Philip was a darling man. I mean, his worst quality was his ambition, which made his career possible. The later Philip is a far more problematic character. He was obsessive. He was vengeful. He could be extremely petty. He was extremely self-absorbed. And he did sexually objectify women. But as Edna knew, and as the seven or eight former lovers that came to Philip's bedside as he was dying knew, he was the best listener they ever met. He was absolutely loyal, and he never failed them in a pinch. And those are superlative human qualities, and let's not lose sight of them.
And they were people of deep humor themselves, I think, of Edna Shirley.
Let me emphasize that, Chris. It helps having a sense of humor if you're going to be a friend of Philip's, or if you're going to be a critic of Philip's. Edna has it. A lot of people don't.
There's another snippet I'd love you to hear, Blake Bailey, where Philip's talking about Newark. He spoke to us that day in 2006 about his father as a novelist without a novel, which I thought was fascinating. Without, that is, the education or the facility to write a novel. But the son, it turns out, had gone to school on his father's relentless observation of their city, where Father Herman had settled and Philip grew up. Listen to this.
So he knew every house on every street. He knew every basement because people lived in the basements. He knew every stairwell. He knew what dangerous dog lived at the top of the stairwell. He was like the mailman. And he had this map in his head. So I got that map in my head. The city was engraved in my head, too, by virtue of his memory. He did know not only where everyone lived, but how everyone earned a living. And he was a real novelist without a novel. He couldn't write. He only went to the eighth grade. His writing was very poor. His handwriting was poor. His spelling was poor. He could read the newspaper, but he couldn't read a book, really. He couldn't sustain that concentration and focus. But thingism, he had thingism. Like I think William Carlos Williams speaks of it. He knew where everything was, the names of all those things, how things were made, who made what. So those are real novelist gifts, you know. I write about what it is to come from that place that I knew. I happen to come from a place that's become a tragic place. And I don't think if Newark had not burned to the ground, I would have written another word about it after Goodbye Columbus, Portnoy's Complaint. But when I came back from living in Europe for a long time, I realized, as you often realize, it was staring me right in the face. It was right in front of my nose. It was Atlantis that I'd come from that had been lost. And suddenly Newark was Prague. Newark was the West Bank. It was all these places that I'm interested in there where people live under pressure. And I realized the place I came from was now a place where people lived under pressure, and that was lost to those who had once lived there. And then the place became interesting to me, not as a background. It's just a background, really, in the early books, but as a place that had a historical fall, a great historical fall, you know, and still fallen.
2 points. He learned reporting, in a way, from his father, observing, noticing absolutely everything. And secondly, he didn't like being called a Jewish writer, but maybe he was a Newark writer, after all. What did he learn from Newark that he wouldn't have gotten in, say, Boston or Cleveland?
Well, Philip lived in Wequaic, and he said, "I was as secure and happy as an Indiana farm boy." You know, this was this all-Jewish, lower middle class neighborhood. You knew all your neighbors. Everyone looked out for each other. And that was wonderful. And it was a good thing to write about, too, because Newark suffered a terrible historical fall. There were no more Jews to speak of in the Newark suburbs by the time Philip had grown up. The 1967 riots practically destroyed the city. So this childhood world of his was like Atlantis. It was lost forever. Right. And so that was a powerful exercise of nostalgia for Philip. I thought it was hilarious what he says about Herman. And I think it's absolutely right that his father was a natural born storyteller. Everything triggered a story. Everything contained multitudes to Herman. So that's, I think, absolutely where Philip got the storytelling impulse. As far as his mastery of the language, that absolutely did not come from Herman. There's that funny part at the end of Goodbye Columbus where Brenda shares, you know, her father is a Polish immigrant. He's written her this letter, quite loving and heartbreaking about, you know, finding her diaphragm. And she hands it to Neil to read. And he stops for a second and says, why does he capitalize all these letters? You know? And that was Herman. You read his stuff, his letters to Philip, and it's like a child wrote them. You know, a total random capitalization, the punctuation's all over the place. And he was not an articulate man. It's fascinating that Philip Roth emerged from that.
Coming up, tenderness in Roth's fiction around his ex-lovers, score settling with his ex-wives. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Once upon a time, Philip Roth, as a fledgling novelist, was famous for a so-called Roth Doctrine. The gist of it, I recalled, was that the wonders and weirdness of American life had overleapt the imagination of even the best writers, which didn't prevent Roth from trying over a lifetime to distill the spirit of the age in human drama. I asked him in conversation about that doctrine and about where the country was in mid-2006. It was year three of George Bush's war in Iraq.
The Roth Doctrine, as you call it, appeared in a talk I gave at an Esquire symposium when I was 27 years old.
My word.
It was my first public appearance as a writer, and I was scrambling to figure out what to say. Esquire magazine was then had a great literary moment, and they published a lot of us, Updike and Cheever and myself and Jimmy Baldwin and Bill Styron and Mailer. Yes, absolutely. And every year they had a symposium, a literary symposium for 3 days, and I was quite flattered to be invited. So I had to give this talk, and I didn't know what the hell to talk about. I was frantic. I was crazed. And finally, a day or two before, I wrote The Roth Doctrine. And all I said in that piece was that having read 20 or so books that had been published that year and the year before, I noticed that none of them were about the big public scene. They were all about private lives. Salinger was at his height then, and so on. But that the writers I did think were of the first rank weren't tangling with the big scene, and I wondered why. Your question presupposes that something drastic has happened between X and 2006. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, we only know the symptoms. There's a kind of, even before 9/11, a kind of infantilism. The grown-ups disappeared. The authorities disappeared. Seriousness disappeared. There's just kind of a fundamental unreality, it seems to me, about so much of the general public discourse in our country in the last, I would say, you know, not much longer than 4, 5, 6 years, but I wonder where it's going.
I don't know, really. It is a terrible moment, I think. Amazingly, I actually hear people say it. I'm old enough now. I'm going to say it now. I'm old enough now to have lived through a lot of terrible moments. It was a terrible moment, December 8th, 1941. I was only 8 years old, but I knew it was a terrible moment. I remember as a child thinking that something that many adults thought we could lose the war. That was a very drastic thought for a child to have, and for the adults too. My father had older brothers, and so I had older cousins who went into the army. We had a big family. So suddenly I had 10 cousins in the infantry. Some of them were in the Normandy invasion. Astonishingly, no one was killed. But that was pretty terrifying, if not for me, for the family. One of my closest friends throughout my life, he's still a friend, lost his brother in 1944. Those were pretty terrible times. And then at the heart of my young adulthood, I lived through the 7 or 8 or 9 monstrous years of Vietnam War. That was pretty, as you remember, horrifying. So this is a different situation, but it isn't the first horrifying public moment that I can remember.
Blake Bailey, pick up on that. Philip Roth positioning himself wonderfully between the out there and in here, the public, the private. Did he live to satisfy the Roth Doctrine?
The Roth Doctrine is deeply misunderstood. What he basically said was that writers of the first rank, particularly Malamud, Salinger, Bellow, Styron, wrote about the inner life, whereas the second raters, like Alan Drury and Herman Wouk, wrote about the big public scene, and their novels were decidedly third rate. And basically, the speech was misinterpreted in two basic ways. One, that Philip was saying, the big public scene in America has become so bizarre, you shouldn't even try to write about it. It defies even the most refined imagination. Write about your inner life, right? And the other basic misinterpretation was that he was castigating these writers of the first rank because they didn't have the guts to take on the big public scene. And here was this young Turk, Philip Roth himself, who, by God, was going to kind of turn things around. Neither is true. It wasn't a prescriptive speech. He was just observing a tendency and saying things are really wild and wacky out there. Of course, the young Philip raged against Eisenhower and sort of the pervasive Philistinism of mid-century America. That would come to seem very quaint toward the end of his life when, you know, a multiple bankrupt casino owner and reality TV star became president of the United States. He would have hated to see the America that emerged under Trump.
George W. Bush's America and the war in Iraq were almost too much for him.
Oh, yeah. He said that George W. Bush was the devil. He said that quite seriously and believed it.
I want to hear him, the young Roth again, Blake, if only because Philip Roth was proud to think of himself as a pioneer in American fiction. But deep down, as he recited to me that afternoon, he was really always a man of the old culture, even the academic culture, which he got to know in his first years after college. And when he saw pop culture somehow rising there, out in the distance.
I'd love you to read a passage that struck me in The Dying Animal, which you must have written 6 or 8, 10 months before 9/11. When I read it the other day, I thought, wow, we were waiting for something.
It's about watching the New Year's celebration on December 31st, 1999, to welcome in the new millennium. We watched the new year coming in around the world, the mass hysteria of no significance that was the millennial New Year's Eve celebration. Brilliance flaring across the time zones and none ignited by bin Laden. Light whirling over nighttime London, more spectacular than anything since the splendors of colored smoke billowed up from the Blitz. No bombs go off, no blood is shed. The next bang you hear will be the boom of prosperity and the explosion of markets. Watching this hyped-up production of staged pandemonium, I have a sense of the moneyed world eagerly entering the prosperous dark ages. A night of human happiness to usher in barbarism.com. To welcome appropriately the shit and the kitsch of the new millennium. A night not to remember, but to forget.
It's all there, everywhere. The explosion of markets, the prosperous dark ages.
Yeah.
The kitschification of just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about kitsch.
I mean, I know the word, of course. It's not a word I use very much. When I was a high school kid, I started high school in 1946. Television began in 1948, really. And popular culture just grew and grew and grew and grew. And by the time I was in college or in graduate school at the University of Chicago, David Reisman was there, and he was writing The Lonely Crowd, you remember. And I used to go to his classes, order his classes, and they were in mass culture. The assumption was that there was this thing, popular culture, which we could look at, and it was out there, and it was like Vesuvius, you know, it went off only once every 6 billion years, that it was contained in some volcano. And we heard its rumblings, and we looked inside, you know.
And what was it when you looked?
So it was just that there was, in it, there was great cheapness, great shallowness, and stupidity, ignorance, etc. And that this popular culture was taking over American entertainment, they thought. They didn't think at that moment that it would take over everything. That when it erupted, we'd run like hell from the lava, you know. And when last seen, we were still running. But what I'm getting at is that back in 1955, say, in that classroom, we all thought the University of Chicago would win. You know, it would be 21 University of Chicago, 7 popular culture. That would be the final score. I think that was the assumption. There would continue to be an audience of discriminating consumers of entertainment, of books, of art, of thought, of thinking. And it would seem quaint now to sit in such a classroom because you would just have to say, it didn't turn out that way. The other thing has conquered.
There he is.
It's great to listen to Philip again.
But now in sum, I mean, after a lot more years of sort of working on his manhood, on his ideal, do you think of him as somebody at war with his national culture or in some sense an expression of it?
Philip was genuinely dismayed in his everyday life by the level of discourse in so-called cultural journalism. He never stopped railing against how the New York Times, for example, basically never stopped identifying him as the unserious jerk-off artist who had written Portnoy's complaint. And even when he did something rather high-minded or, you know, was about to publish one of his masterpieces, The Human Stain, he always presupposed that they would trivialize it in some horrible way. And in Philip's lifetime, he came to despair of there being anything resembling a literary culture in this country. He said, the day will come, and is almost here now, when novel reading will be as cultic an activity as Latin poetry. Mm. And indeed, toward the very end, you know, the dominance of the screen, be it an iPhone, be it a computer, be it a TV, enjoys considerable hegemony here in America.
Yeah. And he was angry about it.
Well, yeah, he was angry about being trivialized. He wanted to be taken seriously as a writer, and he deserved and deserves to be taken seriously as a writer.
On the rather vast subject of Philip Roth and his women, the ones he married and the many, many, many he didn't, Lisa Halliday won praise and a great deal of respect for a first novel titled Asymmetry that came out of her tryst with Philip Roth in his last years. It was one of those April-November relationships. She was in her late 30s. He was past his mid-70s, for which Roth was, and still is, generally condemned. But Lisa Halliday wrote and spoke of the love in their friendship and the lessons that Roth had gifted her with discipline and delight in her sentences, a style which he gave her, a reading list, personal treasury of music, and literary advice across the board. Here she speaks about it.
I do think it's important to acknowledge that sometimes relationships like this happen, as you say, because both people genuinely want them to happen and both people enjoy them and get something out of them. They teach each other things. And one asymmetry in the book would seem to be that this older character has a lot of power. He's established. He's famous. Mary Alice would like to become established and famous. But she has her own powers and her own influence. It could be insulting to a young woman to suggest that she doesn't know what she's doing, that she shouldn't have a relationship that she wants to have, that's life. We have urges and desires to know certain kinds of people and learn things, and indeed to teach other people what we know and show other people what we know. That's how you grow and compound your experience in life.
Blake Bailey, I'm sure you interviewed Lisa Halliday, but cast a general look at Philip Roth and women. There's some awful stories there. Worst of all with Claire Bloom, his first wife, of course. But there's another side here, and Lisa touches on it. What's your summary view of Philip and these women?
Yeah, Lisa adored Philip. People are so categorically deploring and judgmental of Philip's tendency in later life to have romantic relationships with much younger women, that it was predatory and so forth. He loved telling them what to read. He loved taking them to the movies he liked. That was fun to him. But also bear in mind that while he was having these relationships with much younger women, he was also surrounded by extremely formidable intellectual accomplished women like Judith Thurman and Hermione Lee and Claudia Roth Pierpont and so on. He loved female company.
But we're stuck, Blake Bailey, with a weird picture. I mean, he damaged people. Those 31 books took a toll in the suffering of human beings. And yet there was also this affection. One way to out of it is to see Philip as, amazingly enough, a work in progress, a guy who was studying and learning. He said to you, apparently, I didn't get it about Maggie. I didn't even get it about Claire Bloom. Wouldn't somebody have told him? But then wouldn't a novelist with the human frame in mind all the time have seen those traps? It's a strange thing. I also wonder if we should see Philip not scared stiff, but sort of working fearfully through the big decisions of his life.
Look, Philip's blind spots in his everyday life, that is not a unique phenomenon among writers of the first rank. Again, Philip spent the vast majority of his waking hours alone, cultivating the wisdom that arose from figuring out the puzzle of his work, the geometry of it, as Flaubert would have it. Okay? And like a lot of people who live inside of themselves most of the time, he didn't see what was in front of his nose very clearly. He saw his needs and expectations projected out.
Maybe last question, Blake Bailey. Philip Roth would not have called himself a moralist, although he provoked moral reactions and thought about them. Grown up Philip Roth, what would he say about his pursuit of the good? What was it? And how would he mark himself, do you think, in the end? How do you mark him?
As a human being or as an artist?
Both, I think. And art is one moral good, certainly, in his life, but it wasn't all. His father, he honored, and the Swede, Lvov, in Newark, he came to regard as a moral person in American pastoral. But just broadly, what was his grown-up idea of the good? And comment on his pursuit of it.
As he told Bello, I have to recognize that I am also this repellent person, this highly sexed person, this very selfish person. Let the repellent in. Let me be that person and not be this walking bullseye, as Philip would have put it, this patsy that Maggie had almost destroyed. When I let the repellent in, I was alive on my own terms. Now, what that meant was that, you know, there was this Mickey Sabbath, this amoral, philandering person who answered to nobody but himself, quite selfishly, and the demands of his work. There was the nice Jewish boy who never went away, who visited you in the hospital, who made sure your medical expenses were covered, who adored his father, who had, you know, filial piety toward Bello and Kazin and all the other father figures in his life, and was just a sweet, darling man, as Lisa Halliday, for one, will attest. And finally, there was the isolado, who was utterly alone in the world with his work and with the demands of his work, and was content to have it so.
It seems to me that the charge against Philip Roth is narcissism and a kind of obsession, fixation, in a way, on himself and on sex, which is also just to say he's stuck in a fashion, but he's also writing it with a depth that is hard to match.
I can't argue with that, Chris.
Blake, this is endlessly interesting. You know, I said to Lisa Halliday, I thought Asymmetry was up there near the top of the great Roth novels. I'm almost thinking that your biography is a kind of Roth novel, and it would be high on the list.
Well, thank you. That's the ultimate compliment.
Blake Bailey, thank you for 800 pages on Philip Roth, 8 years of hard work, and for this conversation.
I've had a great time. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Philip Roth, the biography, is Blake Bailey's big book. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from Chris Johnson and Michael Garth. Mary McGrath is working on our novel. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.